I have been watching the boxers from the other countries, Heidi said, especially the light heavyweights, and I have also been watching you. Yes, he frowned to cover his embarrassment. I saw you. You have nobody to fear except the American. Cyrus Lomax. He nodded. Yes, Ring magazine rates him the best amateur light heavyweight in the world. Uncle Trump has been watching him also. He agrees that he's very good. Very strong, and being a nigger, he will have a skull like solid ivory. He is the only one you will have to beat for the gold, she agreed. The gold. The sound of it on her lips had a music that quickened his pulse. And I will be there cheering for you. Thank you, Heidi. They boarded the bus, and when the men in the other seats glanced at Heidi with admiration, he felt proud to have her at his side. My uncle is a great follower of boxing. He thinks, as I do, that you have a good chance of beating the American Negro. He would very much like to meet you. It is kind of your uncle, said Manfred. He is having a small reception at his home this evening. He asks me to invite you. Now you know that is not possible, he shook his head. My training schedule. My uncle is an important and very influential man, she insisted, holding her head on one side and smiling appealingly up at him. It will be very early. I promise you, you will be home before 9 o'clock. She saw him hesitate and went on, It will make my uncle and me very happy. I have an uncle also. Uncle Trump, said Manfred. If I get your Uncle Trump's permission, will you promise to come? Heidi was waiting in the Mercedes at the front door of their house in the village at 7 o'clock, as she had arranged. The driver held the rear door open for him, and Manfred slid onto the leather seat beside her. She smiled at him. You look very handsome, Manfred. She had plaited her top blonde hair into two thick gleaming ropes and piled them on top of her head. Her shoulders and the upper slopes of her stately bosom were bare and snowy perfection. Her blue taffeta cocktail dress matched the colour of her eyes perfectly. You are beautiful, he said, with wonder in his tone. He had never paid a compliment to a woman before, but this was a mere statement of fact. She lowered her eyes, a touchingly modest gesture from someone who must be accustomed to male adulation. To the Rupertstrasse, she ordered the driver. They drove slowly down the Kurfürstendamm, watching the throngs of merrymakers on the brightly lit sidewalks, and then the Mercedes accelerated as they entered the quieter streets of the westerly section of the Grunwald district. This was the millionaire's village on the western outskirts of the sprawling city, and Manfred relaxed and settled back against the leather upholstery and turned to the lovely woman beside him. She was talking seriously, asking him questions about himself and his family and about his country. Quickly he realized that she had a much better knowledge of South Africa than he could have expected, and he wondered how she had acquired it. She knew the history of war and conflict and rebellion, the struggle of his people against the barbarous black tribes, and then the subjugation of the Afrikaner by the British, and the terrible threat to their existence as a people. The English, she said, and there was a knife edge of bitterness in her tone. They are everywhere, bringing war and suffering with them. Africa, India, my own country. We too have been oppressed and persecuted. If it were not for our beloved Führer, we should still be staggering under the yoke of the Jew and the English. Yes, he is a great man, your Führer, Manfred agreed, and then he quoted, What we must fight for is to safeguard the existence and reproduction of our race and our people, the sustenance of our children and the purity of our blood, the freedom and independence of the fatherland, so that our people may mature for the fulfillment of the mission allotted it by the Creator of the universe." "Mein Kampf," she exclaimed. "You can quote the words of the Führer." They had passed a significant milestone in their relationship, Manfred realized. "With those words, he has captured everything that I feel and believe," he said. "He is a great man, head of a great nation." The house in the Rupertstrasse was set back from the road in large gardens on the bank of one of the beautiful Havel lakes. There were a dozen chauffeured limousines parked in the driveway, most of them with swastika pennants on their bonnets, and uniformed chauffeurs waiting behind the wheels. All the windows of the large house were lit, and there was the sound of music and voices and laughter as their own chauffeur let them out of the Mercedes under the portico. Manfred offered Heidi his arm, and they went in through the open front doors, crossed a lobby of black and white checkered marble slabs and panelled walls decorated with a forest of stag antlers, and paused in the doorway of the large reception room beyond. The room was already filled with guests. Most of the men were in dashing uniforms that glittered with the insignia of rank and regiment, while the women were elegant in silks and velvets, with shoulders bare and hair bobbed in the latest style. The laughter and conversation subsided as they turned to examine the newcomers, and they were interested and calculating appraisals, for Manfred and Heidi made a strikingly handsome couple. Then the conversation picked up again. "There is Uncle Sigmund," Heidi exclaimed, and drew Manfred into the room towards the tall, uniformed figure who came to meet them. "Heidi, my dear," he stooped over Heidi's hand as he kissed it, "you grow more beautiful each time I see you." "Manfred, this is my uncle, Colonel Sigmund Bolt. Uncle Sigmund, may I present Herr Manfred de la Rey, the South African boxer." Colonel Bolt shook hands with Manfred. He had pure white hair, scraped severely back from the thin face of an academic, with good bone structure and a narrow aristocratic nose. "Heidi tells me that you are of German extraction." He wore a black uniform with silver death's head insignia on the lapels, and one eyelid drooped, while the eye itself watered uncontrollably, and he dabbed at it with the fine linen handkerchief he held in his right hand. "That is true, Colonel. I have very strong ties to your country," Manfred replied. "Ah, you speak excellent German." The Colonel took his arm. "There are many people here this evening who will want to meet you. But first tell me, what do you think of the black American boxer, Cyrus Lomax? And what will be your tactics when you meet him?" With discreet social grace, either Heidi or Colonel Bolt were always on hand to steer him from one group of guests to the next, and the wine waiter brought him a glass of mineral water when he refused the champagne that was offered. However, they left him longer than usual with one guest, whom Heidi had introduced as General Zoller, a tall Prussian officer in field grey uniform with an iron cross at the throat, who, despite a rather undistinguished and forgettable face with pale, sickly features, proved to have sharp, incisive intelligence. He questioned Manfred minutely on the politics and conditions in South Africa, particularly as to the feelings of the average Afrikaner towards their ties to Great Britain and the Empire. While they spoke, General Zoller chain-smoked a series of thin cigarettes wrapped in yellow paper with a strong herbal odour, and every now and again he wheezed with asthma. Manfred quickly found that he was sympathetic and had an encyclopedic grasp of African affairs. The time passed very quickly before Heidi came across the room and touched his arm. "Excuse me, General Zoller, but I have promised the boxing coach that I will have his star back before 9 o'clock. "I have enjoyed meeting you, young man." The general shook Manfred's hand. "Our countries should be good friends." Manfred assured him, I will do all in my power to bring that about. Good luck for the games, Herr de la Rey. In the Mercedes again, Heidi remarked, My uncle liked you very much, and so did many of his friends, General Zoller for one. I enjoyed the evening. Do you like music, Manfred? He was a little surprised by the question. I enjoy some music, but I am no expert. Wagner? Yes, I like Wagner very much. Uncle Sigmund has given me two tickets to the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra for next Friday. The young conductor, Herbert von Karajan, is performing a program of Wagner. I know you will be fighting your first bout that afternoon, but afterwards we could celebrate. She hesitated, and then she went on quickly. Forgive me, you think me forward, but I assure you. No, no, I would be greatly honored to accompany you, whether I win or lose. You will win, she said simply. I know you will. She dropped him in front of the team house and waited until he had gone in before she ordered the driver, back to the Rupertstrasse. When she got back to the colonel's house, most of the other guests were leaving. She waited quietly until he came back from seeing the last of them away, and with an inclination of his silver hair, ordered her to follow him. His treatment of her had altered completely. It was now brusque and superior. He crossed to the unobtrusive oak door at the far end of the room and went in ahead of her. Heidi entered and closed the door behind her softly, then drew herself to attention and stood waiting. Colonel Bolt left her standing while he poured two balloon glasses of cognac and took one to General Zoller, where he sat in the winged back chair beside the log fire in the stone fireplace, puffing at one of his herbal cigarettes with an open file on his knees. So, Fräulein, Colonel Bolt sank into the leather chair and waved Heidi towards the couch. Sit down. You may relax in your uncle's house. She smiled politely, but sat stiff-backed on the edge of the couch, and Colonel Bolt turned back to the general. May I ask the general's opinion of the subject? And General Zoller looked up from his file. There seems to be a grey area surrounding the subject's mother. It is confirmed that his mother was a German, as he claims. I am afraid we do not have confirmation on that. We can establish no proof of his mother's nationality, although I have made exhaustive inquiries amongst our people in South-West Africa. The general belief is that she died at childbirth in the African wilderness. However, on his father's side, there is a definite documented proof that his grandmother was German and that his father fought most valiantly for the Kaiser's army in Africa. Yes, I see that, the general said testily and looked up at Heidi. What sentiments has he expressed to you, Fräulein? He is very proud of his German blood and he looks upon himself as the natural ally of the German people. He is a great admirer of the Führer and can quote at length from Mein Kampf. The general coughed and wheezed and lit another cigarette with a taper from the fire before turning all his attention back to the red file with the eagle and swastika emblem on the front cover. The others waited quietly for almost 10 minutes before he looked up at Heidi. What relationship have you established with the subject, Fräulein? On Colonel Bolt's orders, she said, I have made myself agreeable and friendly towards him. I have in small ways conveyed my interest as a woman towards him. I have shown him that I am knowledgeable and interested in the art of boxing, and that I know a great deal about the problems of his fatherland. Fräulein Kramer is one of our best operatives, Colonel Bolt explained. She has been given a thorough grounding in the history of South Africa and the sport of boxing by our department. The general nodded. Proceed, Fräulein, he ordered, and Heidi went on. I have conveyed to him my sympathy for his people's political aspirations and made it clear that I am his friend, with the possibility of more than that. There has been no sexual intimacy between you? No, my general. I judge that the subject would be offended if I were to proceed too rapidly. As we know from his file, he comes from a strict Calvinist religious background. Besides which, I have not received orders from Colonel Bolt to initiate sexual advances. Good, the general nodded. This is a matter of major importance. The Führer himself is aware of our operation. He considers, as I do, that the southern tip of Africa has enormous tactical and strategic importance in our plans for global expansion. It guards the sea routes to India and the East, and in the event that the Suez Canal is denied our shipping, it is the only route available. In addition, it is a treasure house of raw material vital to our military preparations. Chrome, diamonds, the platinum group minerals. With this in mind, and after my meeting with the subject, I am of the firm belief that we must proceed. Therefore, the operation has now a full departmental sanction and a red rating. Very good, my general. The code name for the operation will be White Sword. Das Weiße Schwert. Jawohl, my general. Fräulein Kramer, you are now assigned exclusively to this operation. You will, at the first opportunity, initiate sexual intimacy with the subject in such a way as not to alarm nor offend him, but rather to strengthen our hold over his allegiance. Very well, my general, she said. In due course, it may be necessary for you to enter into a form of marriage with the subject. Is there any reason why you could not do so, if required? Heidi did not hesitate. None, my general. You can rely on my duty and loyalty entirely. I will do whatever is required of me. Very good, Fräulein. General Zoller coughed and hunted noisily for breath, and his voice was still rough as he went on. Now, Colonel, it will suit our purpose if the subject is a winner of a gold medal at these games. It will give him a great deal of prestige in his home country, apart from the ideological aspect of a white Aryan triumphing over a person of an inferior black race. I understand, my general. There is not a serious German contender for the light heavyweight title, is there? No, my general. The subject is the only serious white contender. We can make certain that all matches which the subject fights are refereed and judged by members of the party who are under the control of our department. Naturally, we cannot affect the decision in the case of a knockout, but... Naturally, Bolt. But you will do all in your power, and Fräulein Kramer will report daily to Colonel Bolt on her progress with the subject. Both the Courtney and Malcolmus clans had descended upon the luxurious Bristol Hotel rather than the Olympic Village. Though David Abrahams had bowed to the dictates of the athletics coach and moved into the apartment house with his teammates, so that Chassa saw little of him during the days of hard training leading up to the opening of the games. Matilda Janine prevailed on Tara to accompany her to most of the field athletic training, in return for equal time shares of her company at the polo fields. So the two girls spent most of their time dashing from the vast Olympic complex across Berlin to the equestrian centre at high speed, the only rate of progress with which Tara seemed able to conduct her father's green Bentley. The brief layoff from training, combined with the imminence of the games themselves, seemed to have sharpened David's running rather than harmed it. He returned some excellent times during those 5 days and courageously resisted Matilda's genuine suggestion that he should sneak out for just an hour or two in the evenings. "You are in with a chance, Davy," his coach told him, checking the stopwatch after his last run before the official opening ceremony. "Just concentrate it all now, and you'll have a bit of tin to take home with you." Both Chassa and Blaine were delighted with the ponies that their German hosts had provided. Like everything else in the equestrian centre, the grooms, stabling and equipment were all without fault, and under Blaine's iron control, the team settled down to concentrated practice and were soon once more a cohesive phalanx of horsemen. Between their own long sessions on the practice field, they watched and judged the other teams whom they would have to meet. The Americans, expense not considered, had brought their own mounts across the Atlantic. The Argentinians had gone one better and brought their grooms as well, in flapped-brimmed gaucho hats and leather breeches decorated with silver studs. "Those are the two to beat," Blaine warned them. "But the Germans are surprisingly good, and the Brits, as always, will be slogging away at it." "We can flatten any of them," Chasseur gave the team the benefit of his vast experience, "with a little luck." Tara was the only one who took the boast seriously, as from the stand she watched him tear down the side field. Sitting tall in the saddle, a beautiful young centaur, lean and lithe, white teeth flashing against the dark tan of his face. "He's so big-headed and cocksure," she lamented. "If only I could just ignore him." "If only life wasn't just so flat when he's not around." By 9 o'clock on the morning of the 1st of August, 1936, the vast Olympic Stadium, the largest in the world, was packed with over 100,000 human beings. The turf of the central aisle had been groomed into an emerald velvet sheet and ruled with the stark white lanes and circles that marked out the venue for the field events. The running track around the periphery was of brick-red cinders. High above it rose the Tribune of Honour, the reviewing stand for the traditional march past of the athletes. At the far end of the stadium was the Olympic altar, with its tripod torch still cold. Outside the entrance to the stadium stretched the Maifeld, its open acres of space containing the high bell tower with the legend, "Ich rufe die Jugend der Welt." I summon the youth of the world. And the massed echelons of athletes were drawn up to face down the long boulevard of the Kaiserdamm, renamed for the solemn occasion the Via Triumphalis. High above the field floated the giant airship, the Hindenburg, towing behind it the banner of the Olympics, the five great linked circles. From afar, a faint susurration rose on the cool, still morning air. Slowly it grew louder and closer. A long procession of open four-door Mercedes Tourers was approaching down the Via Triumphalis, chromework gleaming like mirrors, passing between the closed ranks of 50,000 brown-uniformed stormtroopers who lined both sides of the way, holding back a dense throng of humanity, 10 and 20 deep, who roared with adulation as the leading vehicle passed them and threw their right arms high in the Nazi salute. The cavalcade drew to a halt before the legion of athletes, and from the leading Mercedes, Adolf Hitler stepped down. He wore the plain brown shirt, breeches and jackboots of a stormtrooper. Rather than rendering him inconspicuous, this sombre, unadorned dress seemed rather to distinguish him in the mass of brilliant uniforms, gold lace, bearskins and stars and ribbons that followed him between the ranks of athletes towards the marathon gate of the stadium. "So that is the wild man," Blaine Malcomis thought, as Hitler strolled by, not 5 paces from where he stood. He was precisely as Blaine had seen him portrayed 1,000 times, the dark hair combed forward, the small, square moustache. But Blaine was unprepared for the intense messianic gaze that rested upon him for a fleeting part of a second, then passed on. He found that the hair on his forearms had come erect and prickled electrically, for he had just looked into the eyes of an Old Testament prophet, or a madman. Following close behind Adolf Hitler were all his favourites. Goebbels wore a light summer suit, but Göring was portly and resplendent in the sky-blue full dress of a Luftwaffe marshal, and he saluted the athletes casually with his gold baton as he went by. At that moment, the great bronze bell, high above them, I felt, began to toll, summoning the youth of the world to assembly. Hitler and his entourage passed out of sight, entering the tunnel beneath the stands, and a few minutes later, a great fanfare of trumpets, magnified 100 times by the banks of loudspeakers, crashed over the field, and a massed choir burst into Deutschland über alles. The ranks of athletes began to move off, wheeling into their positions for the entry parade. As they emerged from the gloom of the tunnel into the sunlit arena, Schasser exchanged a glance with David marching beside him. They grinned at each other in shared excitement as the great waves of sound amplified music from the bands and the choir singing the Olympic hymn, and the cheering of 100,000 spectators poured over them. Then they looked ahead, chins up, arms swinging, and stepped out to the grandeur of Richard Strauss's music. In the rank ahead of Schasser, Manfred de la Rey stepped out as boldly, but his eyes were focused on the brown-clad figure far ahead in the front rank of the Tribune of Honour, and surrounded by princes and kings. As they came level, he wanted to fling up his right arm and shout Heil Hitler, but he had to restrain himself. After lengthy discussion and argument, the counsel of Blaine Malcolmus and the other English speakers in the team had prevailed. Instead of the German salute, the team members merely snapped their heads around in the eyes right salute as they came level. A low whistle and stamp of disapproval from the largely German spectators followed them. Manfred's eyes burned with tears of shame at the insult he had been forced to offer the great man on the high dais. His anger stayed with him during the rest of the amazing festivities that followed. The lighting of the Olympic torch and the official speech of opening by the Führer, the sky filled with the white wings of 50,000 doves released together, the flags of the nations raised simultaneously around the rim of the stadium, the displays of swaying gymnasts and dancers, the searchlights and the fireworks and the music and the flypast by squadrons of Marshal Göring's Luftwaffe that filled and darkened the sky with their thunder.